Hello, Alaska. This is Pat Race.
And this is Matt Buxton.
And this is a podcast about Alaska.
Yeah, let's jump in.
This is Pat Race reporting with Matt Buxton from Hello Alaska Podcast Land. I'm working on my radio voices because it sounds like we might get acquired. Is that like?
Yeah.
That's kind of exciting.
Yeah.
Do we want to just jump into that stuff and then talk about the legislature?
Yeah. So it's kind of cool. So I've been working with Alaska Current. This is like a nonprofit sort of, I think they kind of have termed it as a reporters collective. I think we've kind of struggled to find exactly what our purpose has been there. And one of the things the Current really wants to get involved in is podcasts. And so they approached me through the writing there to see if we were interested in making this a more regular thing, because that's that's sort of been the big struggle we've had so far is, being regular. And really, because this is a hobby podcast, we're not, doing it. We're doing it on our own time. So when it's on our own time, that seems to slip a little bit. So this is an opportunity to have production and regular episodes, which is super cool.
Yeah, I think that, one of the things that slowed us down is that I don't edit very fast on these, it's just like I have a hesitancy to sit down and edit them, and then it just becomes kind of a to-do list pile thing. And it's hard to sit, if you just recorded a thing, it's...
I've never gone
through this. Hard to sit down and edit. Anyways, when you said, hey, they might edit this for us if we do it more regularly, that sounds great to me. I'm very excited. Definitely there's, a little bit of, an anti-institutional streak in me that's I don't know. I kind of like having my trashy hobby podcast with Matt, and I don't want it to be anything different. But I think I'm coming around the corner on that. We've had a couple preliminary meetings with these guys, and they seem good, and I'm excited about it. And so I guess, we don't know the shape of it. I guess this is all kind of in transition. We haven't signed any papers or anything, and we probably have some thinking and talking to do still. And I maybe wanted to talk through some of that today, just to sort of surface it for people who have been listening for a while and might be invested in what we're doing and have an opinion on it. And so, yeah, there's this opportunity ahead of us where we would maybe be able to make the podcast more frequently. And I think that that's the main thing, that when someone comes up and says hey, they don't say hey, I like your podcast. They say, hey, when's your next episode? and I think I'd like to be able to deliver that a little more frequently and with some more regular cadence.
Mm-hmm. So the kind of the in sort of really general, not in ink terms yet, we're looking at going to twice a month with sort of some flexibility here and there. So we're kind of, feeling it all out right now, but I don't know. I think it's really exciting. This is something that we started this podcast so long ago, and we had so many big ideas of what it could be. And we wanted to have so much, collaboration and interaction with the listeners. And we wanted to be able to have these sort of big conversations about not just what's happening now, but what has happened before, and what are these big conversations about where we're going. And we never really quite got it, right? We never got it to that level. And so I'm really excited to sort of be able to revisit a lot of those ideas and hopefully give them, the effort and attention that they deserve, because we really love doing this podcast, and there's so many ideas and so much great stuff to be done, because we know at the end of the day, we are Alaska nerds, right? Yeah. We love talking about this state. We love living in it. We love, understanding it better.
Well, I think both you and I have a real love for the people that we're here with, and just see and appreciate the work they do. And I'm very excited. I'm thinking about our early episodes and some of the more ambitious things that we did. We did a lot of deep dive episodes. We did a lot of multi-part episodes on complicated issues. We interviewed some interesting people. We included a lot of arts and culture early on. We played music. We had, I think that there's just a lot more we can be doing. And I think this is going to give us some latitude to do it. For me, What have we made? I think we made $250 over 94 episodes off of this effort. So to be able to have a little bit of paid time, and I haven't even had that conversation yet, but if it's a number greater than zero, that's like more minutes I can devote to this. And I'm very excited about the possibilities of taking this on as a more professionalized task, or, you know, like something that I can actually like, doesn't feel like I'm carving out personal time for.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And for me too, I mean, there's a little bit of like the added bonus of, you know, for me doing this podcast, having these conversations with you and all that has always been like a re-energizing thing for the writing that I do. And I think that, you know, we've talked about it a lot, is that like I struggle with a lot of ups and downs with this sort of self employed lifestyle I live, and sort of the pressures and expectations that we put on ourselves. And I think that these conversations remind me, you know, why we do this, you know, and what's important about it. And also just kind of helps me clear my mind and kind of figure out a big issue that I'm trying to tackle.
Yeah. Yeah. I've noticed that. It's really, it's been kind of fun to feel like a collaborator. Like every once in a while I'll get this really put together, like bang up, you know, newsletter from you, and I'll be like, oh yeah, that's what, like we had the rough draft conversation that was a little lumpy and halting and then it turned into this amazing thing. Yeah.
So yeah, that's going to be the big thing, is we're going to have to learn a little bit, or we have to learn to be better about not making such lumpy audio to start off with. Is I think that Pat's done a really great job at reining me in, but as we've been talking about this podcast, I've realized just how much I like to repeat myself and restate myself and restate what you just said. I think it's like the very first draft writer instinct in me, where everything just can be cut like 25%.
I will miss meticulously editing out the phrase, "It's just so frustrating."
Yeah.
They'd be like, you say that so often. I had one time my buddy Bob texted me and he said, "Man, Matt's really frustrated." and I was like, "You don't even know how frustrated he is. You guys don't even know." It's oh my gosh. Anyways, I'm very excited about this. I think stepping back.
Yeah, that might be a segment coming soon to you.
Oh, that would be a fun one. Yeah. Like yeah. I think stepping back a second though, one of the things that like in this that was, you know, like a kind of a red flag for me was, they're like, maybe let's think about changing the title, right? And then we went through this sort of process of like, all right, well, I guess we can think about it. And then we just like couldn't come. We came up with some terrible alternatives and then sort of retreated back to like, definitely it's still Hello Alaska, but it will be kind of a reboot. So I think we're going to start over at episode one. And for me, that was also a problem because we're on episode like 90. This is maybe episode 95. And I really, really, really like was excited to get to episode 100. And I don't, you know, it's just a number, but it's a nice big round number. Also, I had the terrible naming convention of putting a zero before like zero, episode 001, right? So I was so excited for it to actually just like roll over to be episode 100 and not have a weird zero in front of it. And they took that from me. But I think what we're going to do, and you and I have talked about this, I think that we're going to just knock out like a couple little mini episodes just to fill us in, get us to episode 100. And then when we start again as, you know, Hello Alaska with Matt and Pat at the Alaska Current or whatever it becomes or gets branded as, it'll be episode one. But for the people who have been listening, they will secretly know it is episode 101. And then that will set the world right with me. Okay. So we can talk about what those things are later, but I'm definitely going to do the giant cabbage for one of my
picks. So a little bit of news, a little bit of our favorite stories. I want to talk about the day that Tongue-gate took over the Alaska legislature, and I'll leave it there.
Okay. All right. Well, so let's see. Today.
So what are the news items we want to talk about today?
Well, I think today, like the main thing for me is I listened to the Begich speech And I think, and you live tweeted it, so I know you were paying attention. So I think that's something we can talk about today. And then, oh, I should say Nick Begich, just because we have a lot of active Begiches in politics. And then kind of just what's going on with the legislature. And I think that you wrote a really interesting piece on fluctuation of oil prices. And that might be good to dig into, given sort of the like global context and how Alaska's sort of at the mercy of that, roller coaster, as you put it.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's talk Begich. He came to Juneau and gave a speech at the Capitol building, just like Sullivan did a week ago. And then, I didn't go up there with my sign. I really wish I did, because it looked like there were a bunch of like people had seen the anti Sullivan signs and came out with pro Begich signs. So they're always like, "Yay Nick!" signs.
So that was I thought that was really interesting. Yeah,
yeah.
It was such an interesting. I think also a very Juneau Republican sort of move.
Absolutely, I recognize all those people.
Those are all people who like understand the optics of Gavel, Alaska, specifically, and I feel like that's just a very unique crowd, right? Mm-hmm. It's like most people aren't watching the hallway cam of Nick before Nick Begich's address to the legislature. I thought it was really interesting. So this is his second address. His first address, I think, was a lot more like kind of lockstep with Trump. I think there were a lot of lines there where he was talking about how like the pain and all the stuff that Doge was doing at the time was like a good idea and worth it.
Yeah.
And I would say that this one was markedly less partisan. I think that he didn't really mention Trump a ton. He didn't, he talked a lot more broadly about like kind of just Republicans in general, but there wasn't like the same level of grievance. There wasn't like, oh, it's the dirty Democrats' fault. Everything's the Democrats' fault. And Joe Biden and Chuck Schumer. That's my Dan Sullivan impression.
I don't think he even mentioned Chuck Schumer, right?
Like, right. Yeah. And I think, too, it was interesting. I think in Sullivan's speech, he brought up the Working Families Tax Cut Act, which is how they're rebranding. You might know it better as H.R. 1.
Yeah.
Or the big Trump's Big Beautiful Bill.
Right.
So, and so Sullivan is very clearly like trying to rebrand it all and kind of like put a new fresh coat of paint on it all. So I think he might have said that phrase like 15 times during his address. Begich said it once. I think honestly it's a good kind of calculation, right? I think that he sort of has seen the kind of traps that Sullivan's sort of falling into where Sullivan, I think, is really dismissive and kind of like happy to fall into that political element of it, where by kind of just sort of sidestepping it altogether, kind of sort of downplaying the Trump stuff, even had like some mild criticism for Trump getting rid of the solar projects and renewable energy, said it wasn't a good fit for Alaska. Those are all sorts of things that I think are frankly like smart recalculations for him.
Yeah, well, he's on a 2-year election cycle, and I think he's just, you know, he just ran, right? And so I think he's just a lot more in touch with Alaskans than Sullivan, who can go and like fuck off to DC for 6 years and then come back and tell us how great everything is and then leave again.
So, I mean, my initial takeaway was like, this guy's not going to lose an election anytime soon necessarily. I mean, I think that like this year's, you know, I mean, that we can get into it because Republicans are definitely running into this election with a lot of massive problems.
Yeah.
I saw here is like the kind of maybe just even if it's a show of centrism that I think there's a lot that like the independent or moderate Republican people can look at and be like, this guy isn't so bad. I think that there's a lot. And I think Matt Schultz, the Democrat running against him, had a good statement basically talking about how Begich like just admitted basically it was sort of bipartisan looking by omission, really. Like there was so many or moderate by omission, so it's like all the sorts of things that he sort of ignored or left out are kind of the big issue, right? Like the healthcare costs, the deportation, the arrest and deportation of a 5-year-old, right? Like those are all things that he just sort of didn't have to talk about. And
I'm surprised that didn't come up as a question. Because he wouldn't, you know, that came up for Sullivan a week ago on the day it happened. And Sullivan sort of dodged it by saying I hadn't heard about it yet or whatever, right? He said he hadn't, right. he didn't know what they were referring to or something. And I don't think Begich could have made that excuse. I'm wondering what he had in the can to address that if he had been asked about it.
Yeah. So, exactly. So I think that, like, you know, it's a weird sort of, like, matter of optics, I think. But I think that his, you know, wasn't as frustrating as the Sullivan one sort of was. As far as just, like, we talked about it as, like, Sullivan just really sounded like a whine or, like, blame factory, right?
Oh, my God, yeah.
And here it just didn't feel like it in the same way. So I think just from that perspective, it was a better, you know, it was a more successful appearance for him than it was for Sullivan. So
there were a few things that stood out to me. One is that he early on in the speech, you know, at the top of the speech, he said that with the war that we're in right now, that there needs to be a clear purpose and a clear path forward. And he said that's a responsibility of both the president and Congress, which I thought mm-hmm. was, you know, that's right now we're there, you know, they just failed a vote on congressional oversight of the war, and you know it's a congressional power, and there's a lot of criticism of Congress right now for not taking an active role in reigning in the executive branch. And so for him to signal even a slight eagerness to have some congressional authority over the executive branch is, you know, that's better than not saying that, which is what we got from Sullivan.
Yeah.
And he also said he went and sat down and he listened to stories of people in Anchorage who had been displaced from their homes during the typhoon. And I felt like that was interesting too, because, you know, he was asked about that later, but that he had already kind of addressed that, talked about the need for financial support for folks. And he knows that it's not there. He may know it's not forthcoming, but it's also something that he's like attuned to. And so just in terms of like him reading the tea leaves and understanding who he's speaking to, it felt like a lot more in line with what the legislature was there to hear. You know, we talked about, there was a bunch of like rah, rah, rah energy development stuff. That's the kind of stuff you expect. But some of the more subtle stuff felt like he was a little more in tune with the realities in state.
Yeah, I agree. I thought the comments too about, you know, the Trump administration canceling a bunch of renewable projects being like bad I thought kind of good. I mean, I think that's exactly the sort of message that Alaskans have been trying to say over a lot of this time is that, you know, that not only are all these sort of Trump actions like bad on their face, but they are especially bad when applied to Alaska, a place that is very different than many other places. So I think that is I think he's talking to he knows the crowd he's talking to and is doing that job part of it well. So
another thing that leapt out at me was that he strongly endorsed the Stop Insider Trading Act. So he doesn't want Congress trading on information that they have. Mm-hmm. And he said that he's not trading while he's in Congress. So I don't know if that'll turn out to be accurate in the end or what, but you know, like that he said that is interesting, you know, cause he's a proponent of these like cryptocurrency bills that would basically offload the sort of like top heavy, ready to implode cryptocurrency market onto the American taxpayer. Mm-hmm. And as someone who has invested in cryptocurrency and made a bunch of money off it, that's really benefits him. Right. And so if he's I don't know, when he says he's not trading while he's in Congress, does that mean he's still sitting on a pile of cryptocurrency that's going to balloon in value while, you know, while this bill passes?
Or if it's, you know, being managed by somebody else, right?
Right, yeah. So I think that, like, understanding what it means, I'm not trading while I'm in Congress, does that mean he's not holding some of these assets, or does that mean he's just, like, locked in and ready to go? Because it does, you know, like, sitting on $1 million of cryptocurrency and then passing a bill that, like, quadruples it, like, sure seems... like, you know, like the same sort of thing.
Yeah.
So we'll see how that goes. The other thing that really made me uncomfortable and angry even was he quoted an RFK Jr. thing.
That, oh no! Yeah, that was the worst part. Was
just terrible. He said, bizarre. He said, "Healthy people have 1,000 dreams, and sick people only have one dream." And I was like, what the fuck? Like, that can't be a real quote. And I went and, like, looked it up, and it's a thing that RFK Jr. is, like, spouting off, and he's basically implying that the only thing that a sick person dreams about is being well again. And It's really fucking gross.
It is really, I mean, I think that to me was a moment that I think calls into question everything else. Like, I mean, as normy as it kind of came off, like, you know, more traditional Republican-y,
that was weird. And that was in the Q&A section, so it felt a little more unvarnished, like less polished, less, you know, it wasn't like in a written speech that he was referring
to. And it's like, and I think too, it kind of points a little bit toward, I think, some of this guy's, you know, more fringy conspiratorial beliefs, right? Because a lot of this MAHA movement is like a weird kind of like amalgamation. I wrote about this, like amalgamation of like kind of sensible like health information, like, you know, that we should all eat better and
we should all eat active. A jug of protein powder a day.
Yeah. But then it's like mixed with this like wooey woo kind of like wellness QAnon pipe, you know, wellness pipeline sort of stuff. So, you know, and a lot of it is very clearly, I think, designed to at sowing like distrust and mistrust in the healthcare system, right? Which is like sort of the foundational thing. So it's like, you know, RFK's real purpose isn't really to make Americans more healthy. It's to make him less trustful of the healthcare system. And so I think that is, I think, a pretty alarming sort of thing to come up in a speech.
Do you think that's true? Like, to what end? Why? Like, if we don't trust healthcare, then we don't have to pay for it? I don't know. I think
that's part of it, right? Because like part of his argument is that the correction to health insurance, high health insurance costs, is that people need to eat more vegetables, I think, right? And more beef tallow.
Yeah.
So I think that the idea is that people will be so healthy they won't need health care, right?
Yeah.
And I think, and that's what's, you know, it's such an interesting part of it too, is that they keep on talking about how there was this rampant fraud in health, the ACA marketplace. And that's why they had to not renew the credits. And
I didn't understand that.
Yeah. And so what they're talking about, this fraud,
yeah,
is people who bought plans and never used them.
Why is that fraud?
Because in their mind, if you're not getting a product out, if you're not getting service out of it, then it's
no. That's how insurance works. Like, I, as a healthy young person, pay into a system, and then if something tragic happens, that's insurance. That's the whole. That's like the definition of insurance. Yeah. Like, I bought car insurance for so many years, I never got in an accident, and then when I needed, Is that what they're talking about?
That's pretty much what they're talking about. Oh, there's a little bit of like wrinkles on it, but it's more or less like they're looking at people who weren't utilizing their health insurance.
Oh my god, we got to stop the fraud in the car insurance industry.
I mean, it's sort of funny because it makes me think of that. There's a Simpsons line from Ned Flanders, like, "Oh, I don't buy insurance. That's a form of gambling."
yeah. There's a lot of like distasteful things about insurance, but when you look at some of the structures of like, why do we have car insurance, and why is everyone required to pay into it that's driving a vehicle? It all makes sense. It's because like when you have an accident, it can be catastrophic and you can have costs that exceed what you're able to cover, and you need to be able to pay for the damages, right? And so that's the price of getting into that vehicle, is that it must be insured, right? And that makes sense to me from a policy standpoint. You know, there's a lot of like little ticky-tacky insurance things that I think that should be totally optional. And if you can cover it out of pocket, you shouldn't have to get the insurance.
Yeah, totally. But, I mean, it's like, yeah, the whole system is definitely busted, but it's like not, it's just but not busted in the way that they are acting, right? Like, you know, and it was so interesting too. It's basically his take on the health insurance premiums is like, well, once somebody brings me a plan to tackle all that fraud, then I'll consider, you know, fixing the plan. And it's just like, okay, well, aren't you guys the ones that are in leadership? Aren't you guys the ones that, like, ostensibly have the power to fix this stuff? And I think that really, you know, to me, a lot of it is speaking to the fact that they're really just kind of making excuses to do something, to not do what they already don't want to do.
Yeah.
Right. So that they are kind of claiming the system's all broken. And it's like, yeah, there are problems with it. But instead of fixing the problems, you're just sort of like acting like it doesn't deserve to be fixed. Right. And so I think the fact these healthcare premiums, you know, I think the difficult thing with them is that, you know, it's a relatively still small portion of Alaskans, right? I think that there's nearly, it's about 30,000 Alaskans that buy health insurance through the private marketplace. I think about
through the
two
ACA?
Or three. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm one of those Alaskans. Mm-hmm. I buy my healthcare and my wife, we get our healthcare through the ACA, and it's gone up. And that's why people are dropping off their plans, right? So the prices go up and people have to evaluate, like, am I going to pay for this or am I not going to? And then you get healthy people leaving because they're like, well, I'm 27. I'm not going to, I can probably skate.
Not going to pay the same as my mortgage for healthcare.
Yeah.
You know, so I think the numbers that I've seen floating around is roughly like 2,000 to 3,000 people dropped out of the marketplace for whatever reason, right? So,
right.
But it had been growing. So it's not, you know, not only did we not, you know, the growth stop, but also it dropped. So I think that the preliminary numbers that I've seen floating around are like something like 2,000 to 3,000 people dropped out of the system. That is, you know, a reversal that was going up, had been progressively going up since those, the enhanced subsidy had been passed. And so not only did it not go up by, I think it had been going up by like about 1,000 people a year. So not only did it stop growing, it went down. But I think that, you know, I think the calculation is those aren't that many people, right? And I think that there's like sort of a concession among those Republicans that, you know, yeah, these people were getting really boned, but it's just not that big, you know, it's just not that many votes, and that it's not going to be spread out that much, that, you know, the political fallout for it is, so, you know, probably not to them, it's just like not that motivating, right? And I think that...
There was a guy in the newspaper whose monthly healthcare costs had like gone up to $3,000 or something like that.
And I think that they just sort of assume that it's like, well, that person probably wasn't going to vote for me anyways. And I think that that's really
what was it? Yeah.
It's really frustrating. It's going to be interesting because one of the other big things about the Working Families Tax Cut Act, or Big Beautiful Bill, is that a lot of the most sort of like tangible negative effects that it's going to have as far as people's access to healthcare, as far as like food stamps, that sort of stuff, is really designed to land after the 2026 election. So a lot of the broad sort of like pain that this sort of cohort of like 30,000 people on ACA insurance are feeling currently, there's kind of like the 1 in 3 Alaskans that are on Medicaid. You know, I think that a large number of them are going to start feeling some level of discomfort, whether it's, you know, these new work requirements, whether it is cuts other places in government. You know, there's a lot of like bureaucratic sort of burdens that are going to be on the state as far as processing applications. So I'd assume, you know, that processing application times, those backlogs are going to get worse. You know, there are questions around funding for SNAP and Medicaid, or SNAP specifically, that would really increase like the state's share of that program in a way that like a lot of states, the only answer for a lot of states is going to be to like reduce the program, tighten the eligibility standards so fewer people are on those programs. So I think that you know, these are all sorts of things that are really going to start playing out after this election, which I think is really, really notable and interesting.
Yeah, and we already have had problems with the SNAP backlog. There was an article just recently about OCS like just being unable to fill positions. So yeah, the more federal stuff that falls down onto the state level, the more people are going to just not get served by those programs, and the more those programs are going to be useless, and then the more people are going to point at them and be like, look, this program's not working, we should just get rid of it, which is kind of the classic thing, like break it a little bit and so you can get rid of it all the way.
Yeah.
Anyways, speaking of sort of like national and the outside influences on the state of Alaska, one of the big things right now is that we're seeing this like wild oscillation in oil prices. And you wrote about that this last week. What, tell me about how that's impacting our state government. Like, what does it mean when the price of oil goes up $10, $20 in a few days?
So I kind of think this quote from Senate President Gary Stevens last week's news conference, so this is like before it went really crazy even, kind of sums it up well, which is, so I'll, you know, it's, quote, a lot of excitement, certainly not supportive. I mean, we're concerned about what's going on in the Middle East and the deaths that have occurred and the destruction that has occurred. But, you know, one of the benefits is that we should see some higher oil prices. Mm-hmm. So I think it, like, really, to me, like, encapsulates this, like, really kind of uncomfortable nature of Alaska's, like, budgetary revenue system where,
yeah,
you know, human suffering equals, you know, more money in the treasury. So the attack on Iran has obviously, you know, sent oil prices into kind of this sort of crazy spikes and already, you know, tribulations, I guess, in the last few days. And it's, you know, I think it's a good reminder that our revenue in Alaska is, like, tied to this highly volatile thing. So you're going from, I think we went from, like, $70 barrel to $80 to $90 to $120 to back down to $80 to $90 to back down to $80. And each one of these is kind of like, you know, each step above where we're at is good news for the state, you know, the current state of the budget. That's more money. But it, like, kind of is stepped up and down from, like, yeah, pretty good. You know, it's going to make things a little easier to, like, oh my God, we're going to pay out massive PFDs and everything solved forever, to, like, back down to, all right, well, it's, like, a little bit different, you know? And so I think that, it's really interesting because, like, they have to figure out this $500 million draw for the current year. There's a big deficit in the current budget year. So they're really watching these prices closely. But, you know, it's a good, I think there's the reminder is that basically where oil has been since the attack on Iran, it needs just to be higher than that to take care of all of our budgetary issues this year.
Does that shake out in the supplementary budget, essentially? Like, if the oil prices go back down again and we overestimate, does that get taken care of in a supplementary fashion?
Yeah, so, like, likely what's going to happen is that the supplemental budget, I mean, so in an ideal world, so with, yeah, where they have the votes, they would be passing the budget with a constitutional budget reserve language in there that basically says whatever the whenever we run out of money this year, we'll pull the rest out of the constitutional budget reserve. Mm-hmm. So if a bunch, so they could pass that language and then oil goes up to $100 and whatever a barrel, and then that money wouldn't come out of the fund. So yeah, it only comes out of the fund if we run a deficit. So if we end up with more oil revenue, it would be taken care of.
Does that happen every year, or is that the tricky thing that requires, like, a three-quarters vote and gives the minority a bunch of, like, weird bills and stuff?
Well, it only really happens when we have a deficit, which, okay, we've had a deficit pretty much every year, right? So, yeah. So it's what happens when they don't have. Yeah. So we often will hear about it, you know, now. Usually those three-quarter votes are taken care of when the budget passes,
yeah,
the first time around. But now it usually has been pushed off until the supplemental budget, as really the House Republican minority has been much more willing to use it as a lever point. You know, it used to be that, well, it was just a matter of...
It's always been used as a lever point.
It's always been used as a lever point, but it always has almost always been, okay, what's the asking price? And then, you know, it's a political problem that you get through, you know, $30 million or whatever of additional spending on pre-K is usually what it is when the Democrats are in the minority.
Yeah.
Here, the Republicans have, I think, more frequently just said no, like, have not made, either had too many asks or unrealistic asks or just weren't willing to give the vote in the first place. And so it kind of creates these problems where it either gets pushed off until the supplemental budget, or they have to get really weird and creative, or, you know, there's a conflict in the Middle East and everything is taken care of, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah, well, I mean, and that's the, I think where you started with this is sort of that the tether of Alaska's windfalls with human suffering on the global scale. And we, you know, we saw that during the invasion of Ukraine where oil prices spiked and we made a bunch of money and everyone was like, oh yay, we can fund a school this year. And it's not a good It's not a good system, really. And one of the things about it is it's not very predictable or stable. We can build better budgets if we have certainty that money will be there year after year. You know, you can put things in there that aren't just like one-time funding that are, you know, you can cover ongoing deferred maintenance because you can plan around it instead of having to cut it when there's an emergency. And then when you get a windfall, no one's racing to spend it on fixing a busted building that's been neglected for 20 years. They're putting it into some special project or some big thing, or their, you know, the next pipeline or whatever it is. And so having just a little more like less of a roller coaster from year to year would give us, I think, a little bit more of a level-headed budget.
Well, there was a proposal at one point that would have basically relayed out how we fund government, which would have been basically the POMV draws. This is the percent of market value. This is the endowment draw from the Alaska Permanent Fund. That would go to government, and then the oil revenue would go to dividends. Mm-hmm. And I kind of like that, honestly, because then I think it sort of reflects. You know, the cost, but also ties those payments would get bigger in years where oil has been more expensive, which means that gas, heating fuel, those sort of things are more expensive. So I think that it would like actually pair pretty well with that. So I think that would be a really interesting sort of way to change it, because then I think that there is that less of a boom too for government spending, right? So
yeah,
if you only can spend what the POMV does, and the POMV is sort of designed in a way where it sort of takes care of itself inflation wise. You're drawing at a rate that will allow it to continue to grow. I think that like kind of makes sense, and it would sort of, I think, put a cap on those big rich years, right? You know, this week too, there was, you know, the Alaska Beacon had a great story about how the legislature is advancing the largest prison budget in state history. The talk about the prison budget is, you know, at least the explanations we've heard is that, oh, you know, it's a downstream cost. Their costs are kind of, you know, something that's sort of out of their hands because of policy. And it's like, man, didn't we had a whole bill, a whole like criminal justice package that was specifically designed to avoid this problem from becoming a reality, right? And, you know, this would be Senate Bill 91, much maligned criminal justice bill.
Yeah.
But much of the, you know, the talk behind that was, hey, look, our prison budget is getting crazy. And it's getting crazy with a lot of like pretrial people who have not been convicted, who shouldn't really be in jail, you know, for this long, all this sort of stuff. And, you know, then the 2018 election happened and it all went away. So
the Senate Bill 91 stuff was so weird. Like the year that happened, like crime was getting really out of hand because we had this massive opioid epidemic and people were just like stealing stuff all over town.
Yeah.
That's when my hockey gear got stolen and my bike got stolen. Gear. And like, yeah, this guy like busted into a closet near where I work that I was keeping my stuff in. And he stole my bike and hockey gear. And I got like video of him like riding down the street with like a, you know, just all crooked because he's leaning one way with the hockey bag and trying not to fall over. And he's wearing a bathrobe and he's just like, and you're just like, this guy is obviously messed up. And the police just like wouldn't do anything, and it was nuts. And they were like, this new legislation can't do anything, can't arrest people anymore, that kind of stuff. And you're like, no, that's not at all. There's no way that's what is happening here. And it just felt like there was, I don't know, to me, it felt like there was some sort of like resistance inside the law enforcement that was like, we need to make this look real bad so it goes away or something. And I don't know if that's unfair, but it just felt like police weren't doing the work and that there was just a lot of crime tied to this opioid thing. And I don't know. I just remember I remember walking a police officer over and being like, this is the guy here in the park that took all my stuff. Can we do something about it?
Yeah.
And like, well, not really.
Yeah. Well, I mean, too, a lot of that, you know, all that sort of stuff, you know, the spike in crime really, you know, was coinciding with the extreme drop in oil prices that correlated with a ton of cuts throughout state government, right? And so you had all these sort of behavioral health services that were being cut, all these sort of things that local governments were losing out on. I think it was a convenient thing to blame, right?
But yeah, that's what it was,
the culmination of so many other factors that
everyone ran on repealing it. Even people who supported it were like running on, like, we got to get rid of that bill that I definitely didn't vote for.
Yeah. And so I think that it was such a bummer, I think, because I think it was a really, well-intentioned bill. I think it did the way that I had always had it explained to me is that there's basically a big slate of these like policies that are sort of seen as like the right on crime, effort, which is like this sort of conservative effort to, be more rehabilitation focused and to really kind of bring down this understanding that tackling crime earlier than later is a good idea, basically.
But the problem with that is like that takes time to.
Yeah,
you can't do that in 1 year.
Exactly. Right. And I think, too, the way I'd always heard it explained, too, is that Alaska had basically taken that entire – there's a big menu of options, and Alaska basically went, like, clicked on everything. And so maybe did a little too much too quickly on it, if there was any problem with it. But
yeah. But I guess the point of all this – and I, like,
maybe.
I'm not, like, deep in the weeds on this bill. I don't know – all the ins and outs of it, I fully admit that, but it feels like there were some pieces of it that maybe are worth reexamining.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
And I think too that it wasn't wholesale repealed either. There are some elements of it that stuck around. So we'll see exactly how it.
Okay.
But anyways.
But
in the big picture, going back to oil prices. Yeah. Long story short, oil prices. Yeah, I mean it's crazy. I think one of the things that we're going to be watching, right, is there's base level uncertainty around oil and gas revenue in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
But then you have like the Trump element, right? So you have, this entire war has been sort of hastily put together, sort of sloppily conducted with no real clear like outcome or goals.
Yeah, stated. Divergent talking points, conflicting talking points.
Yeah, and I think that actually, this is kind of what I sort of honestly sometimes see when I am watching Sullivan. But I think that there's like a insulation from like the reality that these people kind of surround themselves with, where like they just sort of dismiss anybody that's not going along with them as like, oh, they're just Democrat leftists. Right. But like there's a ton
paid
of
agitators.
Like, yeah. And so I think that like they really, I think we're shocked somehow that oil price that like Iran so quickly threatened the entire global world economic order, right? And I've been watching every single morning right now, one of the first websites I visit is oilprices.com to like look at how oil is doing each day. And it's been interesting to see not only like just the markets panic, and then Trump way basically floats a nonsense piece of like good news to try to settle the markets. They settle for a minute.
They realize it's not settled and that he's full of shit. And they're no.
So we're only on Wednesday right now. As on Monday, the market started at about $120 a barrel of oil. So if that's what it's going to be from here on out, Alaska's like in magical wonderland again. I think by like midday, it was almost down to $80 a barrel because Trump said, oh, actually, we're going to start, the Navy is going to start escorting tankers through the area. We've actually maybe already done that. That's not true.
Yeah, basically, it's over.
By either the end of day, Monday or early Tuesday, turns out that wasn't the case. They aren't doing that. They don't even have the resources to do that if they want to. And by the way, Iran is already starting to lay mines in the Strait of Hormuz. Right. And now I think we woke up this morning, Oman's oil fields have been under attack.
They blew up the ships that were dropping mines,
ships that are dropping mines. There's like thousands of those ships. Yeah. They blew up like 50 of them. It's this really interesting level of like asymmetric warfare too, where they're talking about how, these drones that they're using or the mines are like hundreds or thousands of dollars a piece versus millions of dollars for the American military gear.
It's a long ways to fly to get over there, boat or whatever.
So it's going to be, I mean, I think that, you know, the way I look at it is who knows, right? And I think to me, you know, there's obviously an opportunity for massive upside here for the state government, right? Off of this, you know, terrible level of human suffering that is about to happen or is currently happening.
Well, we apparently blew up a school with like 100.
Not I mean, I wouldn't say even apparently is, you know, I'd say pretty clearly.
Pretty clearly.
Which is
fucked.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really, really bad. And I think that's maybe the thing to try. I think that a lot of legislators are viewing this. You know, I don't think anybody that is, you know, luckily the people in control, I don't think anybody there is racing to radically alter our budget based on the notion that we're going to have huge amounts of oil for a long time. I think one of the big things we're looking at this conflict right now, or this war with Iran and how it's going to go, is that I think that Trump and company are like freaking the hell out over oil prices and what that's going to mean, because they, you know, that was a huge point of pressure that they used to run for in 2024. It was very effective, as we saw, right? These sort of price affordability concerns. And so for it to be coming back and biting them, not just like, you know, with these powers that are way beyond them, but like literally as a direct cause of their actions, I think is going to try to rein it in. I don't know how well you can, and this is Trump, but at the same time, you know, Trump is the one kind of magical skill that this guy does is that for as much as he constantly and thoroughly fucks things up, he sort of gets away with it, right? Like the market and everything is like not as bad as it otherwise should be, right? So there's been like ways for it to shrug it off. Obviously, you know, the economic, you know, reality is very different for a lot of people. So there's a lot of people who are not doing well under him. But the like broad economic disaster that should have been kicked off is like so far dodged it. So, I mean, I think it's all to say that it's like, who can expect, you know, you can't expect anything right now.
I mean, the stock market's not a good it's what he listens to. But it's not a good indicator of what's happening in our country or in our state. Like most Alaskans, I would imagine, are not, you know, in there doing day trading based on what's happening in global politics. You know, these are, you know, we're talking about big corporations and people with a lot of money that really influence the shape of those markets. And,
and I think for that most of us,
our exposure is like a 401k maybe or an IRA or something like that.
And I think there's a lot of indications too that like consumer spending is being is down a lot, that like people are being more pessimistic about the, you know, financial outlook, and it's maybe being reflected in planning.
Buying fewer burritos because there's a war though. Like that's not where, you know, like that's not the, like I'm not as you know, templating myself, my own experiences onto sort of the average Alaskan, like I don't know that my spending habits change much right now until the price of gas rises and things become more expensive, and I see those prices reflected in like, oh hey, this costs $3 more and maybe I won't buy it now, you know.
Yeah, and I think that's interesting. I can't remember what the number was, but some of these spikes that they're looking at, you know, 120 150 plus. I mean, those are getting into ranges where like economic activity like dramatically starts to change, where people look at stuff and say, "Ah, no, I don't need to do that," or
travel, you know, big energy projects
don't happen.
Yeah.
And the fact, you know, it's like, and that's what's so interesting about the place we're in right now is that like that feels just as likely as oil getting back down to like $60 a barrel, you know. Which is to say, like, we don't know anything about anything really, like, and frankly I don't think they do either, right? And that's like the whole thing is that, you know, my article, I had this big tortured metaphor about roller coasters, and you know, I wanted to talk about, you know, like that, you know, the theme park tycoon, when you build the roller coaster and you test it and it doesn't end, you know, it goes off the rail and shoots the cars into the crowd of people. Like, that's just as possible of the roller coaster that we're on right now as anything. So I think, you know, I really don't envy the legislators being in here, but I think that, you know, the ruling philosophy among the legislators is to be take the more conservative, you know, conservative and safe position on budgeting stuff. And I think especially because, you know, so much of what that money could go for or any of those plans is like, you have the Dunleavy factor on it. So I think that even if we're getting a bunch of money, I think there might be sort of a inclination of like, well, we'll figure that out next year when we got a new governor that isn't such a problem.
Yeah, and I think to ground it in sort of the Alaska policy realm, I think it's a good reminder that we need to build in some shock absorbers so that we're not having big boom years where we're buying ridiculous things that we don't need, and low years where we're cutting, you know, essential boring services that we do need. And in, you know, I think oscillating back and forth between those two things creates a real wobbly sort of ecosystem, which we're in right now. We're seeing that because we've had enough ups and downs that things are falling apart at the same time we're building miniature palaces. You know, it's like, I mean, we've got some real, like, we've done some pretty big gold plated projects over the years, and we've got some essential services just falling off the back burner.
Well, I mean, the state of a lot of the schools is just really frustrating. I think one of the things.
This is gonna be a good bit now that I've brought more awareness to you.
One of the things I think that is hard to like forget about too is that, you know, some of the most sort of painful stories that we hear about the reality of the budget are from schools, right? Yeah. And so many of those schools, you know, we're talking about hundreds of millions, but not even a hundred million maybe. But on the local level, we're talking about tens of thousands of dollars being the difference between activities, between, you know, the opportunities that young kids have, whether they have volunteers or they have, debate class or whatever. I think, you know, the Mount Edgecombe High School is really strong in a lot of people's minds, you know, and there's all these hearings about it. And, you know, it's all over a total deficit of like $1.5 million, right? Which is like, you know, Dunleavy spends $1.5 million on shit all the time, right? And, you know, that sort of money flows out in and out of the state government all the time. And so I think that finding a little bit of that breathing room, a little bit of that stability to make sure that in the lean times we're not cutting to the bone, I think is really important. And I think that's kind of like how Alaska kind of is designed, right? Like we have this constitutional budget reserve that is supposed to be there as a shock absorber. And that's kind of what, you know, it was at $12 billion right before oil went collapsed. And then it, you know, absorbed that shock of oil prices collapsing. And then legislators taking like 4 or 5 years to like finally get around to actually like solving it.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think if we really had that savings in there, it could, you know, bridge us, right? Because this idea with oil roller coasters that it has ups, but it also has has downs and ups, and we're in an up right now. And so, you know, I think that it's ultimately in the big picture, we need to get off of it. As I am feeling myself starting to repeat myself here, the big picture is that we just really need to find more stability in how we fund government.
I notice I feel like I'm swearing more than I normally do, but I think that's, I'm wondering, we haven't really had this conversation yet. Are we going to be able to swear in the new one? They did say that because it's a nonprofit, if we do a new podcast with them, that we can't specifically endorse candidates. So maybe I should get that out of my system.
Big problem for me.
What about the swearing thing?
I don't know. It's probably all right to some degree. I think it depends. You do have to end up, there's like, you can end up with an adult rating on podcast networks. So I think we might want to talk.
So
that's a good question.
We should talk to them about that. If they're into us swearing or getting bleeped or whatever. What else? What else do we need to think about for this thing that we're maybe going into?
Know. Oh, I do want to know what people like think about it, right? Like, so one of the big things that we want to do moving forward, and a lot of this, you know, very aspirational, but it's kind of nice to be an aspirational state of mind.
Yeah.
But we really want to be more active in like hearing from people and hearing from their perspectives. And we're talking about like mailbags and other elements of that for the show. But yeah, like as far as, you know, right now we're on the ground floor basically. So if there are like things that we are not thinking about or people want us to be able to try to incorporate in this project as we move forward, like let us know. We'd love to hear about these things and what you guys like about podcasts and, you know, all that sort of stuff, because we are in the part where we are making those decisions right now.
Yeah, we're kind of reinventing it. Yeah, so it'll be, I'm very excited about kind of going back and being like, oh yeah, here's an idea that we abandoned because we just like didn't have the time or resources, and like that was a good one, and let's do it again.
Yeah, I still need to figure out, like, I'm hoping to one day learn about Vico. Someone could tell me about that.
That'd you absolutely will. You will learn this year, because this year is 2026 and it's the 20th anniversary of the Vico scandal. So I will 100% do at least one episode, if not multiple episodes, on Vico.
Yeah.
With, I mean, you, it was, and for
it,
you.
I joke a little bit, but it really was like, I mean, it all played out before I showed up in Alaska. And I like, for me, like the way I experienced it was like, you know, at, I'd be at like political events in Fairbanks, and they'd go, someone would go, oh, you know that he was in the Vico thing, that, you know, he counted the check, but he didn't take it, you know.
Oh my God.
Kind of stuff. So it was interesting to see like the fallout of it and the but like, I, you know, like to hear more about it from somebody who was watching. Yeah.
Frankly, not enough consequences, but the, it was my, you know, in political activism, they talk about your stepping off the curb moment. Like, when did you step off the curb? When did you become a participant? And for me, I really do think it was the Vico scandal. I was in my 20s and I was, just kind of had started my small business, and I was a few years into that. And, I was aware of politics and I read the news and things like that. But this was like, all of a sudden, just up the street from where I work, the feds are raiding the Capitol building. And everyone's taking bribes from the oil companies. And, you know, it was just, it was a big deal. And, and I was just pissed that, like, it seemed like, it, you know, it's like today when you see this blatant corruption and there's no consequences, how frustrating that is. And I, it's like, what can I do? And so instead of like running for office or writing a letter to the editor, I made a short film and proposed that we buy back the state legislature to work for the citizens of Alaska by checking a box in our PFD. And it would only cost each Alaskan $15 to hire the legislature to work for us.
I know. And that's the thing that's so crazy about Vico, is that it wasn't even that big of checks that they were getting bought off.
It was terrible. Yeah. It was like for a couple of people, it was like a few thousand bucks or whatever. I mean,
disgusting. Probably
there were like other amounts of money that just were never, accounted for. But for everything that the FBI dug up and found, it was just pitiful amounts of money that we were sold out for.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So.
Well, that and more.
We're going to do like five more little mini episodes, and just on random silly bullshit and or interest areas or whatever we come up with. And this might be the, well, we'll do like a real proper last episode, but this is getting close.
I know.
All right.
It's exciting though.
It is exciting. All right.
Although I do already miss the days where like I didn't have to try as hard.
Well, I'm sure that enthusiasm to try hard will fade quickly.
I've had like more Zoom meetings than I've ever had like since COVID started, which is like three.
Amazing. All right. Well, I'll see you later. We'll talk soon.
All right. Sounds good.
Okay. Bye.
All right. Bye.